All right, guys, I found out something a few days ago, and I want to gauge your opinions on it. So, I was at my friend's house for breakfast, and someone came over to the couch with a giant glass of milk, and everyone pretended like that was super normal and okay. And I don't know about y'all, but milk was distinctly dinner drink for me, and milk in the morning, frankly, sounds disgusting.
Well, okay, first off, are you cheating on us, Cleo?
Come on, I have to hang out with someone in Utah. Skyping you guys is wonderful, but I'm a needy human and need endless amounts of in-person attention as well.
All right, fine. I guess that's understandable. We'd just rather not hear about it.
Okay, fine. But I was totally with random people who I have zero connections to and who just fill the void in my heart in between the times we get to see each other. The point is that I'm stuck on this breakfast milk fiasco.
Yeah, I'm really not sure why this is so weird to you, Cleo. Milk in the morning is perfectly normal, and actually for dinner is very weird.
I don't know. I think I'm with Cleo on this one. Milk in general, under any circumstances, is kind of gross to me. But first thing in the morning sounds like literally the worst decision you could possibly make.
Okay, thank you, Aubrey. I'm glad someone else is understanding this. I've been carrying this burden all alone, and it's a pretty solitary existence.
I do what I can.
All right. Well, if you haven't already guessed, you lucky listeners out there have stumbled across the forum where science comes to socialize or discussions on things you definitely were not expecting to discuss. As strange as Cleo and Aubrey have made this conversation already, and I apologize on their
Speak for yourself. Yeah,
behalf,
whatever.
I can assure you that it's actually pretty relevant to what we're going to be discussing today.
Now that's more like it. That's right, because today we're doing another food episode. Yay!
And it's a food episode specifically centered on livestock production, hence the milk conversation. So I'm sure we can expect some lovely stories from the dairy and egg farm Cleo lived on in Virginia a little while back.
Double yay.
Well, before all of that starts, let's give the listeners a chance to learn something informative today and introduce the paper and debate this will all be coming from.
So first, be sure to catch us on Twitter at ISGP Forum and check out all the fun stuff we post on Facebook by going to facebook.com/ISGP Forum. Okay, so the paper in discussion today is from Dr. Ian Wright, who's a program leader at Animal Science for Sustainable Productivity, which is part of the International Livestock Research Institute in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The paper, Improving Livestock Water Productivity, was debated at the 2013 conference Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Focus on Food and Water, that was held in Lincoln, Nebraska.
My first ISGP conference, in fact.
Okay, let's start this off by saying that livestock make up an extremely important commodity around the world, serving as a source of labor, food, and wealth. It's actually estimated that 1 billion people depend on livestock in some way, shape, or form for their livelihoods. Demand for livestock-related products, things like milk, cheese, eggs, and meat, is increasing at an extremely rapid rate. This is due to factors such as population growth, rising incomes, urbanization, changes in dietary preference, and me being an adult now and getting to buy as much cheese as I want when I go grocery shopping.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. Not to mention, yogurt is like an entire food group for me.
Oh, you guys are so gross. Maybe that's just because I'm dairy averse, but ew. Anyway, because of people like you and your wanton dairy habits, the livestock sector now accounts for about 40% of agricultural GDP in developing countries. We should mention now that livestock production introduces a whole range of sustainability issues in developed countries like the US, but today we'll mainly be focusing on implications in developing or less affluent countries. And this 40% of GDP statistic isn't really a bad thing in and of itself, as livestock products not only help create healthier populations, but also increase the wealth of the people involved in the industry. What's not so good is the fact that although livestock accounts for the significant percentage of agricultural GDP, it attracts just 10% of government investment in agriculture.
Huge disconnect.
For sure.
This is an issue because livestock production has a lot of potential to encourage huge rates of productivity, but this lack of investment seems to be stunting the sector's potential. In other words, the potential isn't being realized. People are dying of famine at historically low rates at this point in time, which is great,
But the issue has now shifted away from mere calories per day of consumption to nutritional quality of food. Thus, there's a big demand for more nutritious meat, eggs, and milk in the developing world.
Also, let's keep at the forefront of our minds that although this increase in animal products presents huge economic opportunities, it also puts major strain on natural resources, particularly water. The majority of current global water use isn't going towards human consumption, people. It's actually used for producing food crops and fodder for livestock.
And it's now time for our second acronym of the show today, LWP. This stands for Livestock Water Productivity and is a measure of the efficiency with which water is used to produce economic benefit from livestock. The value for LWP varies widely among systems, and data on different systems, particularly those in developing countries, are scarce.
Gathering data in this case is super important, because without it, it's awfully hard to figure out how and where to improve efficiency of this scarce resource.
And one water policy aimed at maximizing the livestock productivity per drop of water is definitely not going to fit all of the production systems here. A lot of the crops and livestock are produced on small-scale systems that integrate animals and crops, so optimal water solutions for North America and Europe will definitely be different than those for, let's say, Asia and Africa.
And even within those regions, there will be a huge amount of variability. How the farm I worked on allocated and organized its water use was way, way different than the farm just down the road. I can tell you right now, though, that metrics for water use certainly were not being calculated or analyzed on either property, that's for sure. During the hottest parts of the summer especially, I would just stand out with the pigs and spray them down with the hose for at least half an hour. It was all we could do to keep them comfortable. Plus, it was super cute when they made themselves little mud puddles to roll around in and tried to bite the water stream just like dogs.
Right. Okay, so better and more organized irrigation systems are definitely a priority, and they're actually being instituted in some cases. However, these advances don't usually consider or account for actual water use. The systems account for how much water is being used directly by the animals, but the water you use to indirectly support an animal, like water for growing the fodder crops that the animals eat, for instance, simply doesn't get accounted for.
Because of this, it would be really useful for the people responsible for developing irrigation projects to examine relevant cultural and physical uses of water in a particular region. For example, let's take into account a farm's proximity to animals in order to reduce water and crop transportation needs. There's an idea.
Adding to this lack of data, we unsurprisingly know a lot more about water requirements for agriculture in more affluent countries than we do in less affluent regions of the world. For instance, we know that it takes 15,000 liters of water to produce a kilogram of beef in the US, which is insane, by the way, and totally unsustainable. But we have no idea how these water needs shift in different parts of the world and under different farming structures. While we have some information for food crops, there's just really so little comprehensive information that exists regarding water requirements for livestock production.
So it seems that at this point in the conversation, we kind of have two main ideas going on. First, livestock production is booming worldwide, and we need to improve productivity of the industry in order to make it as efficient as possible. Second, it turns out that we have an embarrassingly small amount of data on the amount of water needed to sustain livestock production, thus making it difficult to figure out how to achieve more efficient water use habits.
I'd also add that, according to this debate, these problems apply more so to developing countries as opposed to places like the US or parts of Europe.
And I'd also add that cheese consumption has been proven to have similar chemical reactions in the brain as cocaine does.
Wait, seriously?
Yes. So really, it's not Dee's or my fault that we're addicted to it and just blindly contributing to these problems.
Yes, that was a real accredited study, people. Isn't science just the best?
All right, I eat a decent amount of meat. Seriously, I can't live without burgers, but I'd be willing to bet my carbon footprint is still lower than both of yours just because of your rampant cheese addictions.
Yeah, actually, I would not doubt that. But anyway, moving on, let's get a handle on this question of livestock productivity. Now, we totally get that increasing livestock production as a necessary means to meet rising worldwide demand for food is a controversial topic.
Among both academic and public audiences.
Right. But this particular set of debaters thought that this concern was valid.
And by combining existing knowledge that we already have of better feeding, animal health, genetics, and breeding with new knowledge obtained from technological advances and research, we could increase productivity per animal in order to remedy this food demand. So not more animals, but better animals.
And it wouldn't be a food episode on the forum if we didn't bring up genetic modification, right? The debaters at this conference saw GM technologies as playing an important role in addressing issues of food waste that often stand in the way of efficient, productive food webs.
And as we've mentioned on some previous forum episodes, food waste tends to occur at different points along the food system, depending on where you are in the world. In more affluent countries, the majority of the waste occurs at the fork end, so in the home. Think about that bag of spinach that goes bad and slimy in your fridge no matter how hard you try to use it in time.
I'm beyond guilty of this and I hate myself for it.
Yeah, that happens to me literally every time. But in less affluent countries, most of the waste is at the farm side of the chain, in the fields and whatnot. By combining both old and new farming knowledge, so like combining what we know about animal health and needs with genetic modification, say, we could address both waste issues in addition to fostering better yields and improved nutrition content.
As an example of this increased productivity, we've already seen that sequencing the rice genome has led to a 35 to 47% improvement in digestibility of rice straw, simply by starting the growing process with genetically optimal strains. And in case you're not a rice farmer, rice straw is the byproduct that's left over after harvesting the rice paddy. In any case, arguably the most progress here has been made with sorghum, actually, which has been bred for increases in both yield and nutrition. Similar opportunities exist for corn and wheat, leading to more sustainable global agriculture.
And this is particularly important for this conversation about livestock productivity, though, for two reasons. One, livestock typically like to eat these type of crops. And two, the less obvious one, because of the potential crop residues that result.
And while the name crop residues doesn't sound too flashy or impressive, these plant odds and ends hold a lot of potential. Crop residues generally result from food grown for direct human consumption, and unused parts, like the leaves and stalks from rice, wheat, and maize, are fed to animals.
Not to mention that they can be used for biofuels, and I feel obligated to mention that if you're interested in learning more about the biofuel applications of plant residues, go check out episode 45 of the forum, which discusses it in major detail. Anyway, for our purposes today, crop residues can be grazed over by animals, or they can be harvested. By genetically modifying the crops used for human consumption, we can induce significant improvements in yield, nutrition, and digestibility, all of which gets passed down as better crop residues for the animals as well.
Despite this potential, crop residues are often overlooked, largely because of the lack of communication between livestock and crop scientists. The debaters argued that better communication regarding research and growth of mixed-use crops for humans and animals is required to realize all of these goals. This could be especially beneficial in less affluent countries.
Something we still need to consider in this conversation about crop residues, though, is that there's also little information flow between producers and retail markets, as well as a lack of both physical and regulatory infrastructure to efficiently move new agricultural products to the market once they've developed.
Even in countries that make good use of crop residues, there are still a lot of challenges regarding handling, storage, and transportation. And again, these issues become increasingly difficult in less affluent countries. Not to be a broken record or anything.
Building livestock agriculture as a more sustainable part of the food chain is going to require technological advancements at the production end and behavioral changes from consumers. We're going to need a convergence of consumption patterns so that more affluent nations are reducing consumption of livestock products while less affluent nations can benefit from increases in animal protein.
Economic and market factors are also important considerations in improving small-scale farm productivity. A useful model to turn to and use as an example is Operation Flood, which during the 1970s and 80s made India the largest milk-producing nation in the world. This was achieved through marketing, increasing outlets for milk sales, creating co-ops, and providing cow owners better access to veterinary care. The result of these efforts was an almost doubling of milk yields, allowing enough milk for the region's growing population while still reducing the number of animals required over time.
All this milk talk is honestly making me queasy, but that was definitely a major step towards sustainable production in that example you gave, Cleo. Another thing we need to do is begin measuring actual yield based on region and production system, as opposed to just measuring everything off of North American standards. This would really help scientists understand realistic yield potential and therefore improve yield gaps.
Right. And additionally, metrics like water usage need to be measured in mixed conditions, as this is closer to the reality of farmers working in less affluent countries, where small-scale systems of crops and livestock tend to be closely integrated.
Developing cost and impact measurements for livestock-related water could not only improve yields per acre, but could potentially improve the nutritional impact per water unit. This latter measurement could be really hard to obtain, though, as there are areas of the world where just a small amount of animal protein could significantly affect human health and well-being.
Overall, it was agreed that farm systems must be viewed holistically to include livestock, crops, and crop residues, especially as these all apply to more fully tracking and understanding agricultural water use.
Making this easier would be national governments and international agencies increasing the portion of the agricultural development budget dedicated to livestock from 10% to at least 20%.
Only a few development programs also consider the integration of crops and livestock, creating a need for other international organizations and national governments to incorporate water requirements for feed production into the design of irrigation systems.
The debaters also agreed that these development programs could foster social outreach and extension services, like support groups for those in more affluent nations who find themselves torn between their addiction to dairy products and wanting to lead more sustainable, environmentally conscious lives.
I know that last one was a joke, but actually a support group sounds great right about now.
All right, so I think we've spent a sufficient amount of time talking about cheese on air today, so why don't we wrap this up?
That's totally fine by me. All this talk about animals has me craving some bacon.
You are a sick, sick individual, Aubrey.
At least she's not the one who drinks milk for breakfast.
Hey, Cleo, I thought the cheese bonding made us on the same side again.
I could never possibly choose between the two of you, so I've just decided to ridicule you evenly.
I've been doing that this whole time, and I think it's been working well for me.
Okay, well then, on that warm and fuzzy note, what do you, our listeners, think about the issues we've outlined related to livestock production? Should we be making an effort to improve production efficiency, or should we instead be looking for ways to discourage such high demand for animal products in the first place?
How do you feel about GM technologies improving nutritional content and yield for both human and animal production?
How do you think these types of issues will become exacerbated in a world of rapidly shifting weather patterns due to climate change?
Whoa, that one came out of nowhere.
Still relevant.
Anyway, be sure to reach out to us with your answers to these questions on Twitter at ISGP Forum, and also be sure to stop by our Facebook page by searching for ISGP's Forum.
We look forward to chatting with you about any questions or comments you might have in regards to this week's episode. And also, don't forget to let us know if you think drinking milk in the morning is an acceptable act or not. This is clearly an urgent matter that must be settled.
The correct answer, of course, being no, it is 100% not acceptable. But thanks so much for socializing with science today, guys. And we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.